this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, July 12th, 2009, and this is show number 214. Well, how did you guys like having a special surprise episode this week? I know Donald Burr liked it because he got called out by name. I also got a bunch of great feedback through Twitter, email, comments on the blog, including some smart aleck who wrote on the blog, "Hey, your talk seems to drag. Could you talk a bit faster?" Somebody tweeted me that they actually played it at 2x just to see for the comedy, so that must have been a lot of fun. Katie of the MacCore podcast and the Mac Power Users podcast asked if I would post the slides from that event online, so I posted them up to SlideShare, and there's a SlideShare.net. There's a link in the show notes to that if you'd like to be, you know, go watch some really boring slides. Not a big fan of slides, as my rant last week was sure to say. Oh, I should mention, if you hear birds outside my window, that's because I have every window open and it's 78 degrees Fahrenheit in my house. So you're going to have to live with the birds because I'm boiling here. Plus, Kyle just smashed me in three games of ping pong, so I'm pretty hot. Anyway, let's dig into the show. So, remember last week how I explained the lovely processes of Apple and taking forever to replace my brand new faulty iPhone? Guess what they did next? They sent me a survey. Oh, it was like mulling over a fine wine for me. I rolled around on my tongue every response I could think of. When I tweeted that I was filling out the survey, one follower suggested, maybe you should just include a link to last week's show. So I did. I did talk a lot, too. Anyway, I was very kind to the humans I dealt with because they all did everything in their power, but I totally railed on the policies that kept them from making me happy and the next guy that has the same problem. Now let's fast forward to this week. As I think I mentioned, I bought Lindsay a new MacBook for graduation from college. Now I need to sell her old MacBook. My friend Nancy jumped at the chance, so we made the deal. The MacBook had kind of a wonky fan. When it got really cranking, it sounded kind of funny, like if you played a lot of Flash and it really had to work hard. It sounded kind of funny. So I decided to send the laptop in under AppleCare to get it fixed. Imagine my dismay when Apple sent back a photo of the inside of the laptop showing that there had been some liquid spilled in it at some point in time. Now, I happen to know that Lindsay is at least as clumsy as me, and I happen to also know that she dumped a nearly full cup of coffee in it. But that happened like a year and a half ago, and there were no ill effects on the laptop as a result of that spill. Well, AppleCare told me that I had to pay them $755 to replace the display because, and I quote, "the LCD has been affected." That's not actually true. While there definitely is some crud in there, and possibly there's been some corrosive effects on the metal they point to in the photo, the image on the LCD is perfectly fine. So I called them and I said I thought it was very sweet of them to point it out, but that I was uninterested in paying $755 to replace a perfectly good LCD, and would you please just fix the fan I asked you to fix? Now is when I find out the dirty underbelly of the AppleCare service. They refuse to fix one part of the product while leaving any other part unrepaired. They must return it in a perfectly pristine condition. Did you know about this? I've been buying AppleCare for like a decade, and I never heard about this before. I was appalled to find this out. That means as soon as you do anything stupid to your Mac, the money you spent on AppleCare is completely worthless. Well, the good news is that I know Pat Dengler of YourMacDoctor.com, and she's now fixing the fan for me. I trust her, and I like her style, so it'll all be good in the end. But it got me rethinking AppleCare, that's for sure. Now, I've got to take the cost of AppleCare that I was going to charge my friend for. I was going to, you know, prorate the cost and charge her for that. And I'm paying Pat to fix the fan, and I had to buy the fan. So that AppleCare cost me an awful lot of money. Well, I was talking to Pat about this, and she told me that instead of buying AppleCare, she has what's called a personal articles policy with her homeowner's insurance instead of buying AppleCare. She doesn't buy it on her laptops, and she doesn't buy extended warranties on her camera. She puts them all on this personal articles policy. Well, I called my agent over at State Farm, which is the same company she uses, and while I had to hold a gun to the guy's head to get him to investigate it, he didn't believe me, he was able to find out that it was exactly what she said. The personal articles policy covers those items for accidental damage, including liquid damage and dropping it. Now, you'd think this would cost a fortune, but it doesn't. Let's do a little math here. I just bought two $1,500 laptops. to cover that $3,000 with full coverage with only a $100 deductible, it's only $79 per year. So over 3 years for those two laptops, I'd pay $237 for truly full coverage. Now let's compare that to AppleCare. It was $360 for the two-year extensions on those two machines, even at the student discount. So for $120 less, I would have gotten full coverage instead of this snotty partial coverage I have now. Dang, I wish I'd done the math a month ago instead of doing it right now. I think I may buy it anyway because I have four laptops, and just for the peace of mind, I'd really like to have full coverage. Keep this in mind the next time you're going to buy a laptop and reconsider AppleCare. Now, I don't normally read fan mail on the air. That's just, gratuitous niceness to me because, telling me how wonderful the show is, that seems kind of, snotty to do that. But Leo of Mac Maestro Mac Tutorials over at macmaestro.c.la specifically asked me to read his email on the air. I mean, I can't deny what the fans want, can I? I mean, what else could I do? Well, here goes, and as Leo said, be warned, the following content may contain major niceness. Here's what he wrote. The NoSillaCast podcast shows an amazing way of sharing and knowing much more about your Mac in an extremely nice and comfortable environment of comedy, Silly Allison, and some nice lounge music to keep you nice and relaxed. I always like to listen to the NoSillaCast to increase my good morale, or maybe when I'm on a long road trip. I'll just take my iPod Nano out with my headphones and listen to two or three episodes of the nice NoSillaCast, keeping me up to date with recent news and apps and maybe some little problems I encountered with their solutions. From dumb questions to chit-chat across the pond, Allison really shows what it is to be a Mac user and how good Macs are. I even sometimes take out the good old iPhone 3G and look up the different applications and maybe the show notes of the episode. In the end, the NoSillaCast is the perfect podcast to listen to calm down, relax, and keep up to date with the recent news of a certain Macintosh bias origin. Well, Leo, that's very sweet of you to say, and I want to thank you for forcing me to read that on the air. It was hard, but I managed to pull it off. However, because I try very hard to make this an unbiased show, okay, except for the totally, completely biased Mac bias thing. Anyway, I do think it's only fair if I present an opposing view. I received the following email from Ed Lindquist. It's tough to hear this kind of criticism, but it's important that we all learn from it. Here's how it goes. Darn you, Allison. I started listening to your podcast on my iPod in the car to and from work, but trying to take notes while driving became dangerous. So now I listen at home on my computer. Usually early Sunday mornings. An hour-long podcast turns into a 2+ hour learning session. I have to stop the podcast so I can investigate something you talked about or recommended. Time! I just opened my first wiki page on PBWorks. Now I have to learn how to use it. More time! Then back to your podcast. What additional gems will I find that will even eat up even more time? I should be mowing the lawn and pruning the bushes. What a wonderful way to spend a sunny day in the house on my Mac learning. Oh, ow, ow! Someone's standing in my doorway with a scowl on her face, wondering why she does not hear the lawnmower running. I could start it and then sneak back inside. Love your show. Thanks, Ed. Well, Ed, I truly apologize for all the time I've used up of yours. Perhaps I could search out some podcasts that don't provide information and don't give a better understanding of geek things for you. Maybe a boring one would really help you out. I'll keep my eyes and ears peeled and let you know how I get on with that quest. Again, my sincere apologies for your troubles. Well, I've got a review of a pretty stinking cool gadget coming up next. You may have heard of it if you travel in Uber Geek circles, but perhaps not. Let me sneak up on it by taking you on a trip down memory lane first. So remember ages back, I told you about a tricky gadget Steve bought me for Mother's Day called the Cradle Point. That device allows you to plug in a USB cell phone card and turns it into a Wi-Fi hotspot. It's probably half again the size of a deck of cards, and it's pretty light. Runs on batteries, but it can also be plugged into the wall. I love the Cradle Point because it allows me to share my EVDO signal from the cell phone card with other people. The only downside is that it's a bit of a Frankenstein, because I happen to have an Express Card EVDO card, the V740, so I have to first plug that into an adapter that takes it from Express Card into USB, and then the USB adapter then plugs into the Cradle Point. The whole mess is now, say, 10 inches long with, this big thing sticking out of the side of another thing, and it's got the antenna sticking up, and the card is kind of precariously hanging off the side. Not exactly elegant, but extremely useful. Well, fast forward to from a few years ago to today, when it gets so much cooler. The device I'm testing, you've probably guessed, is the MiFi 2200 from Verizon, which is a teeny tiny little device that puts the Frankenstein to shame. The MiFi is about the size of maybe three credit cards stacked on top of each other, and it does everything the EVDO card and the cradle point do together. It receives the EVDO signal from Verizon, and then it spits it back out to you as Wi-Fi. This thing is so elegant, so simple. It only has one button on it, the power button that glows green to tell you it's on. And it weighs about nothing. Okay, if you want to be picky, it weighs 2 whole ounces. Well, let me tell you about the setup first, which was not in the least bit elegant in my mind, and then I'll go back to telling you how much this rocks. I tried to make some videos of the unboxing using my Flip Mino HD. Now, Steve thinks it's his Flip Mino HD, but he's wrong about that. The videos I made are horrible. I really have an appreciation for people who do these. Maybe they all have able assistants, but this video, I should post it because it's so bad. Half the time you can't see the screen because I'm wiggling it all over the place, not noticing what's actually on screen because I'm watching what I'm trying to do, and I get way too close to things, so it's totally out of focus. I'm overestimating the range of the lens on the Flip, that's for sure. I won't ruin your view of the high quality I can produce, but let me just tell you what I learned in rewatching the videos. I opened the box, put in the battery, turned it on, and then I searched for the Wi-Fi signal coming off of it using iStumbler on my Mac. Sure enough, there was the MiFi 2200 in the list. Awesome! So I launched a web browser and nothing. Well, I couldn't figure out what to do, so I was forced to remove the very small and uninformative booklet, but it did have the tiniest hint that I would have to install the VZ Access software. I have nothing against VZ Access. It's what runs the EVDO card when I plug it into the Mac, but I thought this was a way cool Wi-Fi hotspot. Why on earth would I need software? Well, at least they did one thing that was pretty clever. They put the installation software actually on the MiFi itself. So you take the MiFi and you plug it into your Mac or PC via the included USB cable, and a CD actually mounts on your desktop. Okay, well, they did make that pretty easy. I ran the installer, and guess what? It requires a reboot. You know how much I love a reboot, right? Well, okay, after the reboot, I ran through the software setup, and then I realized why you have to do this whole mess. You have to activate the service on the card. Duh! Well, why didn't I think of that? Well, I suppose if they were clever, they'd find a way to initialize activation via a website you were forced to visit the first time you plugged it in, or the first time you attached to it. You know, like when you're on hotel Wi-Fi, the first time you go in each day, they make you go log in and activate it for the following day. They could do that, but they haven't. Well, when I was done going through the activation, it came up with a big, fat, red fail message. Oh, couldn't believe it. I was so annoyed at this point, I just simply walked away. Later on a whim, I tried to get to it via Wi-Fi one more time, and guess what? It worked! I decided not to look a gift horse in the mouth, and I started happily testing it. Later on, I plugged it in again, and I got the fail message again. But this time, I actually read it carefully. Turns out, when you plug it in via USB, it offers to show you your usage so far this month, which is really handy if you're on one of the lower usage model plans. The problem is that that's the feature that's failing. I tweeted about it, and I got another guy who said his usage check fails every time, too. I tested this on both Mac and Windows, and it fails the usage check on both operating systems. They need to fix that. Well, another downside to this activation nonsense is that you actually have to periodically let it go check the activation, which means you have to run the VZ Access software every once in a while, which is really a shame. I'm surprised that none of the reviews I've heard on this device ever mentioned what a hassle it was to get started, but maybe they expected a hassle because it was from a cell phone company. Anyway, enough whining. How much do I like it? I love it. I really, really love it. It's so incredibly small. The instant on power is fantastic. And sharing is something I love to do, so this is made for me. I've showed it to a few people, one of whom said, "I don't like to share. Why would I want that? It's already built into my laptop." Anyway, I took the MiFi on the road to a conference, and even though the conference had Wi-Fi, nobody could get on because everybody wanted to be on, so the congestion was keeping most people off. I was on the MiFi, as were my coworkers who sat near me, so it was immediately evident how great this thing worked. Now, I could have used the V740 EVDO card plugged into my Express card slot on my Mac and created an ad hoc network via Wi-Fi, but most people are not geeky enough to attempt something like this, and even I wouldn't attempt it if I was using Windows. They claim 4 hours of battery life for the MiFi, and that's exactly how long it lasted for me with constant use, just right about on the dot 4 hours. Now, it does have a power-saving mode that if you don't use it for 30 minutes, it goes into standby mode, but we were cranking away on it, so we used the whole 4 hours. Well, when the thing went dead on me, I figured, all right, I'll just plug it into my laptop via USB, you know, assuming I could charge it and use it at the same time. This is when I ran into something I don't like. It simply would not show up as a Wi-Fi hotspot when it was plugged in. I was really bummed, so I tweeted about it via my iPhone, and I found out from a follower that when you plug it in via USB, it automatically turns it into a modem again, and you have to run that darn VZ Access software or, you know, configure a connection for it to dial. This makes no sense to me. Why can't it be charged but stay a Wi-Fi hotspot? Well, a whole bunch of people responded to me complaining about this on Twitter and told me all I had to do was plug it into the wall via a wall charger. I could keep it as Wi-Fi. Well, that's all fine and good if you have power, but what about when you don't and you still have enough juice in your laptop to charge it? I think this is a poor decision on Verizon's part here. Not a deal killer, but a very unfortunate choice in my book. I'd like to see them give you the option of doing it either way. Well, once I got past that angst and I at least knew I could keep online, I was a bit happier. I did some timing tests, and the MiFi was at least as fast as the V740 EVDO card / Cradle Point combo, which makes sense because they're both Rev A of the EVDO standard, which is same thing as 3G and all that. So it makes sense they'd be about the same. Notice that I said at least as fast, because I ran the tests over and over again, and the results just started varying wildly, even though I didn't move physically and I did all of the tests during the same session. So I tested the MiFi as a modem and then the MiFi as a Wi-Fi hotspot. Then I tested the V740 and the Cradle Point giving out Wi-Fi, then the V740 as a USB modem in the adapter, and finally the V740 straight into the Express card slot. Well, the MiFi as a modem averaged in my tests 2.5 megabits per second down, 750 up. As Wi-Fi, it dropped to 2.3 megabits per second, 740 up. The V740 in the Cradle Point was a little bit slower at 2.3 megabits down, 740 up. So, or actually, that was about the same as the MiFi as Wi-Fi. You following me here? Anyway, then I plugged in the V740 via USB, and the speed dropped way down to 1.8 megabits per second upstream, and it went up a little bit to 780 megabits per second downstream. Finally, the V740 as an Express card device ran at 1.8 megabits per second, the same, but about 720 down. Now, I don't expect you'd follow all those numbers and keep them straight in your head, so I put a chart in the show notes. But the main point is the MiFi as a modem was the fastest, with the worst being the V740 via Express card. I thought this was kind of wonky, so after all that testing in that order, I circled back and went to the MiFi again as Wi-Fi, which was the fastest one, and its speed had dropped nearly 20% since I'd tested it 10 minutes before. And the V740 via Wi-Fi had dropped over 30%. So I basically don't think my tests mean hooey, but since at one point the MiFi and the V740 were both being used via Wi-Fi had the same speed, I think it's safe to say that the MiFi is at least as fast as the V740. You can see all my timing tests in the show notes if you want, if you'd really like to peruse all that data. I mentioned that the device comes with a USB cable, but I should point out that it's both good and bad. The good news is that it's only about a foot long, so in two folds you can wad it up without dealing with some, you know, 17-foot-long cable that you got to find a twist tie for. The bad news is that they're using a micro USB cable. Remember back when I did the review of the Storm, the worst device I've ever used in my entire life? I complained about the non-standard cable they had. Well, it turns out it is a standard. That's micro USB. It was the first time I'd ever seen it. The MiFi comes with that same one. Guess what? So does the Palm Pre, too. Guess I gotta stop calling it a mutant, but for crying out loud, what are they trying to accomplish here? The Mini and Micro are nearly identical in size. The only difference is that it's harder for an old fart like me to figure out which side is up. Man, do I sound like a cranky old man or what? Get off my lawn! Well, I should mention that the MiFi is a fully functioning router as well. You can access it via a web browser and change the WPA password, do some port forwarding for your games or your webcam apps, or even change the standby mode time so you can have it take a nap after only 2 minutes of idle time instead of the standard 30 minutes. The URL to get to the MiFi router interface is 192.168.1.1, which is great for me, because that's the same as the Linksys router, so it's really easy for me to remember. And a lot of geeks know that one, so it'll be nice for them too. One thing I would have liked to have seen on the MiFi is I would like them to include some kind of battery indicator on the device. You basically know when it's about to die, but you don't know when you're half done or anything like that. No little lights to indicate. I did discover when I was messing around in the router interface that you can see the remaining battery power in the router interface. So that was pretty cool. I was really glad to have stumbled over that. As far as compatibility, the Wi-Fi worked great with a Mac. It worked great with Windows, an iPhone, a BlackBerry, and a Palm Pre. I know that's to be expected, but when I show it to people, they just don't believe it's a plain old Wi-Fi hotspot. They assume they have to do something funny to use it. I've been thinking a lot about the business case for this device, and I was thinking that you could have a few of these in your office and check them out to people going on travel. And since you can access it via Wi-Fi, you don't have to mess around with installing software on their machines. Problem is that if the battery dies and they have to resort to using it via USB, they do have to install the VZ Access software. I thought I'd better test it on Windows as well, so I tested it on a Windows machine, and the install was pretty much the same as it was on the Mac. Plugged in the device via USB, it gave me the CD image mounted, and I ran the installer from there. The one thing that was really odd, though, was it loaded version 6.10, which has a lovely Soviet war-era interface reminiscent of maybe Windows 95. It immediately informed me that version 7 was available. So I ran the download, and that version was lovely in comparison, very modern-looking, really looked great. I found it very odd that Verizon included such an old version on a slick new device like this. You know, it's not like the MiFi's been lying around on shelves for months. It was just announced like a month or two ago. Well, now let's talk about pricing. The MiFi will run you $100 after a $50 rebate right now if you agree to buy a 2-year contract. Just like every other cell phone card option, the monthly fees for that 2-year contract are exorbitant in the United States. The V740 runs $60 per month, and so does the MiFi for a 5GB per month plan. You can go slightly cheaper if you think you can stay under 250 megabytes per month. That's not very many video podcasts. Then it's only the princely sum of $40 per month. If you think you want one for personal use and you think you'll use it less than, say, four days a month, you can also pay an unsubsidized price of $269 for the device, but then you can buy day passes on it for only $15 per day. I guess you have to take the overage of $169 upper to the purchase price and realize that's almost 3 months worth of monthly charges on it too when you compare prices to for the day-to-day plan. I think they basically made it unlikely that anyone would choose the month-to-month plan. They do have a 1-year contract, which might be a nice compromise. The cost to buy the device is $169 after a $50 rebate. If it were me, I think I might go for that because who knows what kind of majorly cooler thing might be available in a year. The bottom line is I think the MiFi 2200 is an outstanding engineering achievement, makes a fantastic device for connecting your Mac, PC, Linux box, iPod Touch, iPhone, BlackBerry, G1, or Palm Pre to the internet wherever Verizon has coverage. The price is high, but no higher than that of a cell phone card that only works with computers, and this one and only works for one user at a time. So if you like to share, or you're forced to share with others, the MiFi fits that sweet spot. I'd like to see them do Wi-Fi when charging via USB, and a battery indicator would be very helpful. And of course, I'd like to see the monthly fee way, way lower, but overall, I'm delighted with the Verizon MiFi 2200. Well, I've been using ScreenSteps for, gosh, I think it's over a year now, and I believe I've made about 50 tutorials so far. Some of them are just a few steps long, you know, get a quick little idea across to someone. One of them is a manual that has like 40 pages of instructions. This was really complicated what I was trying to explain. You know, I find it so easy and fun to use ScreenSteps. You know, take a screen snapshot, annotate it, put it in my brilliant instructions, and then simply push export to get lovely PDFs and HTML files I can post online. I never waste a single moment on silly things like formatting or making things fit on a page. ScreenSteps does all that heavy lifting for me. If you'd like to help other people and you've been banging your head on the wall trying to make Word do this for you, do yourself a favor. Buy yourself a present. Check out ScreenSteps over at ScreenSteps.com. Their regular version is only $40, while the pro version is $80, but it gives you a ton of capability if you're serious about making complex manuals. They also have ScreenSteps Live, where they can host your manuals online if you collaborate with a team. Make sure you use the coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, to get 25% off the prices I quoted, and go make yourself happy. Well, we have a very special little recording right now. Sit back and enjoy.
G'day, Al. And I'm not going to say who it is, because you all know. Now, Alison, I know you like to solve problems and mysteries, but there is one mystery I'm begging you not to solve. I call it the Great Chat Room Log Off Countdown Mystery. I'll explain first to those who don't join us in the chat room, but who really should join us in the chat room, because it's an absolute hoot watching Al drink beer and faff about trying to put a podcast together. So at the end of the show, when Stevie P tells her dinner's ready, what a man, what a husband, makes me want to go out. No, it doesn't. Or when she's got something better to do, like a couple of weeks ago, she abandoned us real early just because one of her kids was visiting. Weird priorities, if you ask me. But anyway, to get back on track, Al logs out of Ustream and starts a countdown. 10, 9, 8, you get the picture. Now here's the mystery. We all lose her at different parts of the countdown. We then all post our numbers to see who gets closest to one. It's a lot of fun. Although one of us, whose name I won't mention, gets grumpy when he loses. Now last week, I just shut my MacBook, forgot to log off, and went back to sleep. Later I went to tidy up my desktop and found King Nerd and Queen Dork had been trying to solve the Great Chat Room Log Off Countdown Mystery. God, that's hard to say. So, on behalf of the chat room, I'm pleading with Mr. and Mrs. Geek, please don't solve the Great Chat Room Log Off Countdown Mystery. Love you long time.
Well, Rose, I love that. I can't believe you caught us in there still chatting, the two of us, when nobody else was around. Yeah, I guess calling us dorks and geeks is probably, justifiable. Well, I do hereby promise that we will not put any effort into figuring out why everybody gets a different countdown number. It is fun to noodle on, though. What does it have to do with bandwidth? If Steve's in the house and he doesn't get the shortest number, I think Connor got the shortest number last time, the smallest number. It is fun to noodle on, but okay, we won't solve it, I promise. Well, if you're wondering how to find this chat room that she's talking about, where I faff about while I drink a beer, head on over to ustream.tv/nosillacast at 5 p.m. GMT minus 8 on Sundays, which is actually Tuesday, Monday morning in some other completely different month in Australia. Come on over and join the fun. There's actually a link in the show notes in the right sidebar. Just push the thing that says Ustream and it'll take you right in there. Well, we're still doing our series of Honda Bob testimonials that I recorded at his 30-year anniversary picnic. I'm actually using two testimonials here, because they're actually related. Let's have a listen. All right, now I'm bothering John Vanderjack at lunch. Tina and John and I have been having a nice little discussion here about all kinds of things. So how long have you known Honda Bob, John?
I would guess about 3 years, maybe.
And what kind of Hondas do you have?
We have in the family now, we have we have a Civic, two Accords, and a Acura.
So you're bought in full scale then, huh?
Yeah, pretty much.
Now, do you really wish you could go back to going to a dealer, or are you enjoying Honda Bob?
I'm enjoying Honda Bob.
I'm shocked. Got any good stories to tell about him?
Well, the stories actually come from Bob himself, because when he's out working on your car, not only does he do a great job, but he's got great stories to tell. So you could sit and listen to his stories for hours.
I do notice that we never sit inside. The way I advertise for him, I always say, oh, you can sit inside on your easy chair. But you don't. You go out there and hang with Honda Bob, right?
Yeah, he's very entertaining.
All right, John. Well, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
So you had an opinion there too, Tina?
Yeah, I was just thinking of the jobs we've had Honda Bob do on our four cars. And realize that we only see him when we plan to have something done. It's not like a major disaster happening and he has to bail us out. We've had such good care over the last 4 years of these cars that they're just running great, and I have great security. I was thinking the other day, I was driving on the 405 and at 5:30 in the morning, not too much traffic, but I was going, you know what? I never worry about making it to work in my car. And I was seeing a couple cars along the side of the road having problems. I never think about that. I have great security because of Honda Bob.
Yeah, the peace of mind is just amazing,
isn't
it?
It's worth every penny.
Well, and he doesn't even overcharge.
You
think, don't let him know that he could.
More bag for your buck.
All right. Thanks, Tina. So none of these ads have been staged at all. I simply walked up to these people and said, tell us your story. And remember, these are people who voluntarily went to a picnic for their mechanic. What does that say that this many people would go to a picnic for the mechanic? I mean, seriously, this guy is amazing. If you have a Honda or an Acura and you live in the LA or Orange County area and you would love to have Honda Bob come to your house and make you feel this happy about your cars, give him a call at 562-531-2321, or you can just shoot him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, it's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. How are you this fine Saturday morning, afternoon, evening?
I'm fine, but there's nothing fine about our Saturday afternoon, morning, or evening. It's absolutely miserable here.
Aww.
Bucketing rain, wind, general crappitude.
I need to have my daughter go live there for a little while. She's convinced she wants to live where it rains and it's foggy and cold and nasty out.
Yeah, right.
No, she
that
really
wears
does.
Off mighty quick.
That's why I really think she ought to give it a try so that she appreciates the fact that she lives in constant sunshine. But
yeah, you people don't appreciate how nice it is not to have damp and cold at the same time. That's the worst possible weather.
Oh, well, I do remember the time you were riding your bike in freezing rain. Or no, it was freezing fog.
Yeah, that's never fun because then you come home looking all white like a snowman.
No, I appreciate it. I don't think my daughter does, but maybe she'll get it out of her system. She's talking about moving to Seattle.
I might do it, yeah.
Intentionally.
Oh, she could come visit here in winter. That'll put her off the idea.
There you go. Let her spend 2 weeks there and this should be done.
Pretty much.
Oh, great. Well, hey, let's hit into it. We do have a security light, and I believe I might have actually found this one. Or you already knew about it, but I sent it to you.
You did. You found it again. You rediscovered it.
All right, why don't you explain what we have going on for fun this week?
Okay, so it's a zero-day exploit in Microsoft's Video ActiveX control. The effect that has is that it's exploitable through Internet Explorer, which means that it's a remote code execution.
Ah, and we love those.
Mm-hmm.
So now ActiveX control, one of the ways I've explained it to people is it's this fantastic technology that allows you to run video applications on the desktop controlled by somebody else, which sounded like a good idea until evil came out. If there were no evil in this world.
No, it's much worse. Much worse. It allows you to run any DLL you like. So basically, the web server gets to install software on your machine that then runs.
Okay. Dynamic Link Library, by the way, is what DLL stands for, but that doesn't explain it any better. But basically, a program executable.
Well, no, any program to do anything.
So if there were no evil in the world.
Reach into your computer and run programs, like fully fledged programs, not web apps, real, genuine programs.
Ah, okay. So if there were no evil in the world, this would be cool.
Yeah, it lets you do cool stuff because you can have ActiveX controls for all sorts of things. So in offices, it would be used perhaps to manipulate your calendars and all sorts of stuff from right within a web page, which can be very handy.
Yeah, but on the other hand, there is evil in this world.
There is indeed. And this is where there's some slight good news in this story because it doesn't affect everyone. It only affects people running Windows XP and a certain version of Windows Server. But it doesn't affect Vista because Vista runs IE in what's called a protected mode.
Ah.
For reasons that no one is quite sure of, Microsoft felt it was perfectly okay to have every ActiveX control on your system, even ones that make no sense whatsoever to access through the internet, to run in IE. So you could have a control that might do something that you would never ever want to do from your browser, but might be usable in some other .NET application, and the browser can use it anyway, even if it makes no sense.
Okay.
So rather than having to explicitly say, I want this control to be available through IE and therefore over the entire internet, it's sort of the opposite. You have to say, I don't want this control to be usable over the entire internet by anyone.
Okay.
I.e. completely backwards.
So in order to deal with this zero-day exploit, you don't turn off ActiveX control in its entirety. You can turn off part of it?
Okay, so what they did after they realized that that was a bit of a boo-boo is they invented something called kill bits. And every ActiveX control installed on your machine has an associated kill bit. And if that bit is set to 1 or to 0, I'm not sure which way you have to flick the switch, but if that bit is set, it kills the control from being usable from within Internet Explorer, which takes away the remote part of the remote code execution.
Oh, well, that's kind of cool. So if you know which one to do it on.
Mm-hmm. Now, in really, every control should have the bit set to killed by default, unless you explicitly say, I want the browser to be able to use this. But of course, that's not the way it works. It's the other way around. But Microsoft have very kindly, you found the link to this. It's got a button called Fix It For Me.
That is
which will
so sweet.
Basically evoke an ActiveX control to disable the other ActiveX control.
That's cool. It's kind of, I'm looking at it, it's just a button. It says fix it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a button, but that button can't possibly work without ActiveX.
Okay.
The browser can't normally reach in and turn off things in ActiveX.
Okay.
So in a twist of irony, the only way I can possibly see that button being actually workable is through ActiveX.
Nice irony. I like it. Yes. I'm going to think of it as Kill Bill from now on. That seems easy.
That is what you put in the show notes, yeah. The Kill Bill. Well, yeah, so that's your kill bit. And they're important. And at least now it's, you know, it gives us a way to limit the damage. So the vulnerability isn't fixed by doing this, but you have a workaround which saves you from being nuked over the internet, which is a big deal.
So if you're running Windows XP or Windows Server 2003, you can go to the show notes. You can click on the fix it thing and run this. It downloads a little MSI file to your Windows desktop, and you run that MSI, and it's gonna flip that bit so that it's disabled. And
it's done over MSI. I thought it was done straight from in the browser. In that case, it probably isn't ActiveX.
Oh, okay,
gets rid of fun irony. Mm.
And then they do have a let's see, there's an undo one also. I think for when it's done after they've patched it, that sort of thing. Yeah. Now, they didn't explain whether there's any, if you'll be able to tell you turned it off. I mean, is there some function that won't work, you know, some website that won't do what they needed to do?
Well, the vulnerability is in something to do with how Windows interacts with the TV tuner.
Oh, so it's really obscure.
Yeah, exactly. Why on earth one would want that accessible through one's web browser goes back to my previous point.
Okay, so you may not need that ever to turn it back on.
Yeah, there's no reason for IE to have access to your TV tuner.
Okay.
If you even have one.
Cool. So this is perfect security light. Here's a problem, big fat problem, giant problem. Push this button, fix it.
Exactly.
Good. All right. We got another one, though.
Similar vein. Apple have released Safari 4.0.2 for both Mac and Windows, and it fixes two security issues, the worst of which is a remote code execution.
Well, it's good that, you know, we have balanced reporting here. You know, we've got our zero-day exploit on Microsoft or remote code execution on both OSs. That's nice.
Yeah, it's balanced, yeah. But again, just install the fix and then you're happy.
So just run the patch, right? Run the
or
the
basically
update.
Let software update. It's magic.
So when I've been saying not now, I should stop saying not now and let it go?
Well, perhaps not this minute.
Okay. Yeah, because why does Safari require a reboot? That's stupid.
Because Safari gives you WebKit, and WebKit is deep, deep, deep within the bowels of the operating system. And with the exception of, I think it's Solaris, you can't really strip out a kernel and put in a new kernel while the machine is up. Solaris, being the unbelievably powerful enterprise operating system that it is, can actually basically swap out its own brain while it's running without a reboot.
Hmm. Well, I'm tired of reboots. That's why I push later. I always look at them, if it requires a reboot, then I go later for a week. Till the nag. Yeah, I know. That's not very smart. All right.
I leave it open so it's there and I see it all the time. And then as soon as it's evening time, I just get, okay, now you can do your thing.
But if you leave it open, it bounces in the dock and drags the crap out of it.
Just click on it once so that it gets focused and it'll stop bouncing.
Ah, maybe that's what I should do for a week.
No, it's the for a week bit that's the problem.
Okay. I promise. I'll do it right after the show, after I run the backup.
Oh, yeah. Definitely a good idea, that.
And let me just throw in a little plug right there is if you guys haven't run backups lately, run your backup. One of the things I've told you before that I do is right after we're done doing chit-chat across the pond, I plug in my backup drive, run a backup, because once I lost our entire interview with Bart and I, and Bart was very cranky with me. So from then on, I knew that that's the best time to do a backup. So I have been completely religious on that. And every Monday, I take my laptop into work and I plug in the backup drive I left there and run a backup while I'm working.
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, if it doesn't exist on two hard drives, it doesn't exist.
Right. Absolutely. All right, well, let's get on to our main topic. Research assistant Niraj, actually, who we thought was retired. Yeah, Bart thought he was retired because we haven't heard from him for quite a while. He sent us an interesting article about the reasons for choosing BSD-style licenses versus GPL for free software. And we wanted to kind of talk about it because you had some real interesting insight on that. So why don't you start us at the beginning, Bart?
Oh, I think we should possibly start by looking at the different licenses. And there are more open source licenses than you can shake a proverbial stick at, but they generally fall into sort of three broad categories, or arguably even just two. So the most liberal license is the BSD style license. Berkeley Standard Distribution. It's the license that was used to distribute the Berkeley version, the Berkeley Standard Distribution of Unix.
Oh, okay.
Which is what it was standardly distributing. So FreeBSD, OpenBSD, NetBSD, and Darwin, the core of OS X, are derivatives of that Berkeley Standard Distribution of Unix. And that original distribution was given out under the BSD license, which has been adopted by lots of stuff now. And it's basically about as open as you can possibly get. It is anyone can use this code to do anything and don't have to give us attribution. They don't have to make the outcome open source. They don't have to do anything. They can just use it. It's all yours.
Hmm. Okay.
So here, have it.
Free for all. Basically. Do anything what you want.
Free for all.
So I can take a BSD licensed application, modify it, redistribute it, and I don't have to give it back to the open source community. I could change the license on it when I redistributed?
Yep.
Okay.
And in fact, to give you an example of just how open this is, you may remember the days of Windows before Windows 2000. Windows's networking stack was never really very good. In fact, it was rubbish. Then, as of Windows 2000, it suddenly became fantastic, pretty much apparently overnight. The reason is they took the entire TCP/IP stack from, I think it was FreeBSD, and just dropped it into Windows.
Wow.
No attribution, no nothing. The only reason we know it is because if you decompile the exe, you can see some of the original strings in there that give the old notice that this is FreeBSD code.
So, but that was perfectly legitimate according to the BSD
license. Perfectly legitimate, because okay. that's exactly what the BSD license allows you to do. It's perfect. So, it was Windows 2000, Windows XP, so a lot of the Windows servers, everything up until Windows Vista used that TCP/IP stack.
Okay.
Also, the core of OS X. The reason that OS X is a closed source operating system, and yet it has a core that is from FreeBSD, basically called Darwin, is because the license allows for that. Now, Apple have chosen to keep Darwin open source, but they didn't actually have to.
Hmm, okay. But it's kind of like good manners. You don't have to, but it's kind of considered good.
Hmm. Yeah, also WebKit is under the BSD-style license as well. And again, Apple have chosen to contribute back to WebKit. But Safari is not the same as WebKit. So Apple took WebKit, tweaked it to become Safari, and they give some of their changes back to the community, but not all. So WebKit isn't Safari, but it's inherited from it.
Now, am I wrong in remembering that Chrome is also WebKit?
Chrome is also WebKit, correct.
And have they given back? The Google guys, have they given back?
Yes, Chromium. The Chromium project gives back.
Oh, okay.
But again, they don't give it all back, because Chromium is not Chrome.
Okay. Same kind of thing. Okay, so that's what BSD is.
Then the other, sort of the complete opposite, despite being an open source license, would be the GPL, or the GNU Public License. And the GPL is open source with strings, big time strings, massive strings, huge hunking, not so much strings as cables. If you take GPL code and you edit it and redistribute it, you have to redistribute the result as GPL. If you have a massive code base and you take in a small amount of GPL code, you then have to GPL your entire code base.
So
some people describe it as a virus.
Yeah, well, that kind of, that's kind of dangerous.
Into a code, you, well, don't use... It's the condition. This code is free, but only if you're prepared to take part in free software movement.
Right.
So but, what it means is corporations who are not prepared to go open source can't use this code, but anyone who's prepared to play in the free world is free to use it.
Now, you can use the code for development, but not embedding in your product, if you don't GPL your product.
Well, if you were to use a text editor that was GPL, that wouldn't affect the code you wrote in that text editor.
Right, or C++ compilers, GNU-CC, that kind of thing.
You can use GCC to compile something else, and that won't. But you couldn't stick GCC into a product of your own, some sort of custom Uber Mega compiler you just made. You couldn't use GCC to build upon it.
Right.
So yeah, and there are definite massive successes in the GPL route. GCC is a good example of a GPL product. Linux, can't get much, that's probably the ultimate example, is the Linux kernel and all the Linux distributions that have come up around that kernel. PHPBB, WordPress, I mean, there's a lot of GPL code out there.
I like GPL.
But it's very different to BSD license, despite still being open source. They're both open source.
Okay.
The last one that almost always gets forgotten about by people is the LGPL, or the lesser GPL. And it's sort of a halfway house. If you take LGPL code and manipulate it, you have to LGPL the code that you've created. But if you just take it and put it into your code without changing it, it doesn't spread to your code.
Oh, that's the distinction. Because I'd heard of the lesser GPL, but I didn't know. Okay, so you can use it, embed it in your deliverable code, and you don't have to open source your code.
But if you edit the LGPL component, then you have to.
Okay. Is there a lot of stuff under LGPL?
A lot of libraries.
Okay.
So you can use an LGPL library without having to GPL your entire code base. I've used a lot of LGPL stuff over the years within code.
Huh.
But it tends to be low-level stuff that only programmers care about. No one will LGPL an app.
Okay.
It's just, you know, libraries and components people could use to build apps that tend to get LGPL.
Okay. Oh, I love it. I love understanding that. I'd heard about it for a long time, never knew what that was. Now, I know it's not on your list to describe, but the other big one I've heard about, and I don't know how it works, is the MIT OSI license.
If I could be wrong, but I am 90, there's so many of these, but I'm 90% sure that one is a BSD-like license, as is the Apache license.
Okay, in terms of what we're talking about. Okay, yeah, Apache's another big one, too. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so now you have opinions on these as well.
Okay, well, we should probably back up a sec to the actual article that sparked all this.
Okay.
So the article was basically a description of if you want to get lots of developers on board, then if you close source the project, we need to take one more step back. People tend to get a teeny tiny bit passionate about licenses when they write code. And people who grow up in the closed source world are horrified at the full GPL. It scares the living bejesus out of them. Because they see it as a virus and as the enemy. So they're not going to contribute to a GPL product.
Because
GPL
they want to protect
aren't
what
going
they've
to go
created.
Anywhere near a closed source project because they're almost religiously open source types generally.
Right. Oh, it's definitely a religious war, no question about that.
Yeah. So the only sort of license that everyone's happy to contribute to tends to be the BSD style, because the GPL guys say, yeah, open source project, sure, I can contribute to that. And the closed source guy says, yeah, no strings attached, I can contribute to that. And so his whole argument is based around the fact that we should all use BSD style licenses, because that way we get lots and lots of programmers to join our project.
Oh, I should say the link we're talking about is red-sweater.com, and it was blog 825. It was titled Getting Pretty Lonely. I'm not quite sure what the title had to do with this article, but right. Okay, so gotcha.
Okay, so you sent me the article, and it was a very interesting article, and I couldn't argue with a single thing in the article. My only argument is that it doesn't matter.
Okay.
Don't choose a license to get in as many developers as possible. You choose a license to match the philosophy of what you're trying to achieve. So the BSD guys, when they set out to write that BSD kernel, say, that was used in Windows, their aim was to make the internet safer. And the only way to make the internet safer is to have everyone using secure code. And the Windows stack was a disaster area. So it was their proudest moment when Microsoft took their good, solid, secure code and stuck it into Windows. In one fell swoop, the whole internet became a safer place.
Oh.
Mission accomplished. Likewise, they're the people who wrote OpenSSL, which is our standard implementation of the secure socket layer, which gives us HTTPS and pretty much all of our security that makes the entire internet work. They gave it away for free to make the internet more secure. Mission accomplished. OpenSSH was also written by the same guys under the BSD license, again, to try and make the internet more secure. It's the de facto standard of secure shell. Mission accomplished. So that license worked perfectly for them.
Yeah, I can see that.
Now, the GPL guys, their aim was completely different. Totally different. Their aim, they believe fundamentally that you have a right as a computer user to see what's under the hood. It is a basic right of all computer users to see how code works, to edit that code, and to share that code. And that you should never be denied that right. When you take that philosophy on board, the only license you really could use is the GPL.
So you can't
and
see
the GPL
you can't see inside
that philosophy.
Wait a minute, you can't see inside the BSD licenses?
You can, but it can be taken in closed source, so it doesn't spread that worldview. It doesn't spread the availability of free software because people like Microsoft can just take it and close it.
I get you. Okay.
Whereas with GPL, you can't.
Right.
So if it's your aim to make as much software in the world as possible open, GPL meets your needs.
So it's the philosophy behind what you're trying to achieve. And neither one of those is wrong.
Yeah, they're just different.
Right.
So you wouldn't use, you know, it entirely depends on your goals.
Right.
And I guess the LGPL is for people who can't quite decide what camp they fall into.
Well, I don't know. I can see the logic between LGPL too, is if I've created a product that I really need to, this is my livelihood and this is what I'm going to live on. By GPLing it, I would have to give it away. And by LGPLing or using an LGPL component for it, I don't have to give it away. I can still sell my product.
Sure, that's why you would use an LGPL component. But why would you write an LGPL component?
I see.
Now, in fairness, there are actually valid reasons. It's if you feel, it's sort of for the more pragmatic GPLers. You do believe that the software you write should never be closed and should never be taken out of the public domain. But you also accept the fact that not everyone looks at the world your way and you would like your code to be usable, but nonetheless, to force it to stay open.
Right.
So it's a halfway. It's a more pragmatic approach.
Now, in our initial discussion, you also brought up the closed source, closed license, nobody can do anything with my stuff because my objective is to make a big fat pile of money license.
Yes, that's the other. Yeah, if you're going to go the Microsoft route, as in not open up your code at all, keep it completely proprietary and closed, and also the Apple route, half and half. Apple have a foot in both camps very firmly. They're both firmly open source and firmly closed source all at once, which is maybe a more pragmatic approach again. But yeah, the Microsoft approach is simple. Our code is the crown jewels. It is never getting out, and we are going to milk it for every cent that it's worth.
Now, see, I don't see anything wrong with that either. That's okay too.
Oh, it's not wrong. Again, it's entirely what's your motive,
right? And
what are you trying to achieve?
Making big fat piles of money is, that's the capitalist way. And I think in the email I told you about a company I worked with extensively for years where the sales guy would come in my office and he would say, okay, look, you have money and we want it. What do I have to do to get more of yours? And I love these guys because there was never this, some of the vendors would come to him and say, no, we just want to make you successful. That's all we care about. BS. What you want is to make big fat piles of money. If the way you're going to do that is by making me successful, okay. But, don't lie to me. I love these guys. Yeah, these guys were great because it was just like, give me more of your money. And I'd look at them and say, okay, my objective is to give you the absolute minimum amount of money that I can get away with. So, okay, how do we do that? It just made the negotiations
just complicate
easier.
Things a little. If your goal is to make vast wadges of cash, you are not limited to going down the closed source route. You can go the open source route and make your money through service, which is the Red Hat route.
Mm.
Red Hat makes money. Red Hat are a successful corporation, but their software is open source because they're not selling you the software. You don't buy a license to Red Hat servers. You buy a support contract.
Right. And a lot of people buy those.
Cheaper, Yeah, it works out cheaper because you're not paying for licensing and support. You're only paying for support. Now, as it happens, Red Hat's not the best example because their support sucks. But apparently, if you're a big enough company and you pay them enough money for support, you get superb, amazing, fantastic support.
Okay.
But if you pay them the bargain basement price for support, you don't get any, really, is what? My opinion.
But I think that's okay, too. You get what you pay
True.
For.
Yeah, I guess we just don't hand them enough cash at work. I don't like Red Hat support, but then again, I have to admit, I've never taken high-end Red Hat support. So maybe that's why I don't like it. But there's plenty of other companies using that model. Sun kept Java open. Now, Sun, as a unit, were not all that successful because, well, they're not very well managed. But Java is very successful, and Sun could make big money off it, except for the fact that they're losing money hand over fist everywhere else.
Right, right. It could be good.
MySQL, again, makes its money off conferences and stuff, and training and support, but MySQL is a free product.
Yeah.
So you're not limited to going down the closed source route if your goal is to make a wadge of cash, but you have to be very sure that you are the best at what you do, because if you're not the best at what you do, then someone else will give the service on your software, and if they're better than you, then they'll be the ones making the money. So you do have to be good.
And I don't see any problem with that.
Absolutely not. There was a lot of talk. It didn't materialize really. It sort of kind of materialized, but there was a lot of talk that Oracle were going to make a killing by doing Red Hat support better than Red Hat. we would try to pull the rug out from under them, but that didn't quite work out that way.
Yeah, there aren't a lot of examples of that, but I could see how there could be of where a company takes on service where the company that built the product maybe isn't doing the best job.
And someone else comes in and does better service.
Right, right.
So if that's an open source product... then the company who wrote the software have nothing. Now, having said that, the advantage to open source is that you don't actually have to do all the writing yourself. So although Red Hat is a Linux distribution and Red Hat people write a lot of code, they didn't write the whole OS. They didn't have to write the whole OS because there's millions of people around the world contributing towards the OS.
Right.
So they only had to contribute a small piece.
Well, I like this discussion because it's, you know, a lot of people, when they do get into the religious war, it's, you know, this is wrong and this is right. And it's not wrong or right. It's different. And understanding the difference, I think, is very interesting. And it is important to understand these licenses so that you understand what you can do, what your limitations are. I'm a big believer in you should, just because the software didn't cost you any money doesn't mean you don't obey the license agreement. You obey it at least as robustly as you would the license agreement on a paid-for product.
Absolutely. Yeah, and there are, you know, people can give away software on their own terms. They don't have to use one of the pre-existing licenses. They can just give it away on their own terms, and their own terms may be, you're free to use this for free forever. You are not free to distribute it. That's
yeah,
a perfectly valid
I have
thing
seen
to
that.
Put in your terms and conditions.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of shareware will come. Well, not shareware, because the whole idea of shareware is another model that's kind of died, where you can freely distribute a trial version of this software to all of your mates, but all the cool stuff comes in after you pay us money.
Right. You think that's died?
I don't see much shareware in actual shareware. There's a lot of software you can download for free, which then you have to upsell to get the cool features.
Oh, but yeah, you're right. They used to call that shareware, but it really isn't.
Yeah, because the whole idea of shareware was that everyone would stick it on a floppy disk and give it all their mates. Shareware, I mean, that was the whole distribution model. But now that we have the internet and we all download stuff directly, there isn't really shareware anymore. I mean, do you distribute software to anyone? You just send people to URL.
Yeah, I guess I thought the term shareware just meant that the people who created it would share it with me for some limited time or forever, but with no good features or a watermark or whatever. I considered that shareware.
A lot of shareware works like that because that's the only way they can get money. But the actual shareware, the idea was that you get a stripped down product for free, which you are free to share with your friends.
Okay.
And then you basically become the marketing department on behalf of the company. And it was mainly used by smaller software companies who didn't have a marketing department, who could never go up against the IBMs of the world.
I also consider shareware things under $30. It just feels like shareware.
The other model you have is donationware. Well, the software is given away for free, but it's not open source. It's just free. And you are asked to contribute to the developer if you would like.
Does that work?
Yeah. I used to before I bought the commercial transmit program. I was a big fan of CyberDuck, and I donated to CyberDuck because I thought this is a great product. I want to see it do better, and I gave them money.
Well, I'm not saying I don't. In fact, I talked about it last week with MacTracker. Is I pay them every couple of years because they've been working on it for so long. If I only paid them the first time I started using it, you know, they've been doing it for, I don't know, 10 years or something like that. So every couple of years, I just go back in and give them some more money.
I've also donated to Firefox. I've donated quite a few, actually, because I do believe in supporting software, but it's a voluntary contribution. So it's
I did not know Firefox was donationware. I never remember seeing anything.
It's free
anything.
And open source, but they do take donations.
That's true. Sort of like the NoSilicast. Actually, no, I don't know if it's open source.
It's Creative Commons.
Creative Commons, right. But it is donationware. There is a donation button, you know.
It's not anything where. It's audio.
You can't wear it at all?
Well, no, it's not software. It doesn't run.
Oh.
It's media.
Oh.
Sorry.
You can still donate, though. There's still a button.
You can still donate. Indeed. But yeah, a lot of people often wonder how open source software can keep going. And, you know, there are actually a lot of business models built around it. You know, open source software can be just as much about making money as closed source, and a lot of people don't understand that. So I thought it might be interesting to mention the money aspect as well.
Yeah, yeah. And pay your donationware people, you know, and shareware. Pay your shareware license. Some shareware licenses, they don't do anything to limit you. They just trust you to go back and do the right thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So do it. Do the right thing.
Exactly.
All right. Is there anything else on this topic, or have we covered it all?
I suppose the only other thing to mention is just that whenever I personally release code, which I do on occasion, I always GPL it. It's never particularly good code that anyone might want to share, but just in case it's helpful to someone, I GPL it, and then people can use it if they want. But I'm not happy with someone making a book off my back.
Oh, so they're also not allowed to make money off of it? Is that what the GPL says?
They can make money, but they have to contribute it back.
They have to contribute what they do to the code back, and what they create, they have to contribute back.
Yeah, assuming they distribute it. If they don't distribute it and only use it in-house, then they don't have to do anything.
Right. But so if they, but you don't end up making money because they end up making money necessarily.
Oh, no, absolutely not. Again, they could provide support or whatever. But I like the idea that, you know, this is free to use for people who are happy with the whole free idea.
Right. I like it. What kind of code have you written?
Just a couple of little Perl libraries for this and that, and the stuff I use for my photographs. I've written many moons ago a few PHP BB extensions and some WordPress themes. And a widget.
Nice, nice. All right, well, this has been interesting to me. Hope it has been interesting to everybody else. I wanted to know more about this. I've studied these licenses but never made that distinction between the two, so that was very cool. I appreciated learning.
Hey, no problem. My pleasure.
All right. Well, I think we're on for next week.
I do believe it's business as usual. I think it's 3 weeks from now I have to go to a wedding, so I will be away for a whole weekend.
Oh, you know how I hate that.
Have to figure out what to do then. Yeah, I know. Whenever my social calendar gets interesting, Alison's like, oh.
Yes, I want you sitting by your computer at all times waiting to talk to me.
Yes, you shall not have a life, Bart. Not happening.
All right, Bart. Well, we will talk to you again next week.
Okie dokie. Until then, happy computing.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the show today. I had a really good time. We had lots of fun in the chat room. In fact, the chat room took off and talked about Star Trek for a while I realized I'd forgotten to write part of the show. But, let's see. It was a lot of fun in here. We had a good time. So if you'd like to send in reviews, give me feedback, ask dumb questions, or just chat with me, shoot me an email at allison@podfeet.com. And don't forget to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.